tonight on Arena. Lisa McInerney's story of love on Cork's Shaky Bridge, performed by Hilary Rose. And Siobhan Níl Gunín gets her boat-building father dancing in Bod Huon. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. A City and a Garden is the title of a project which has been brought together by the Body and Soul Festival and Sounds from a Safe Harbour. It's presented as part of the Brightening Air Festival. The project involves a series of narrated short stories centred around specific locations in Cork and Dublin. The stories are written by writers like Lisa McInerney, Louise Hegarty, Gavin Corbett and Malata Uche Okorie, and narrated by actors like Hilary Rose, Connor Lovett, Tola McKay and Dorothy Murphy. Each of the stories will be made available on a specially created website, City and the Garden, from this Friday, June the 11th, and people in Cork and Dublin are invited to walk along the routes described by the authors who share their personal experiences of these locations. Joining me this evening, writer Lisa McInerney, written her own short story based on, I'm told, memories of events in her youth in locations in Cork city centre. And her story has been voiced by actor Hilary Rose, who's also with us this evening. Lisa McInerney, you old romantic, little did I think that Cork's Shaky Bridge would be the site of such tremulous, breathless love experiences.
It's not normally what I end up writing about, is it? I'm normally kind of like experiencing the dark sides of cities. But, you know, to have an opportunity to go back and kind of tell a story that's almost like there are antagonists in it. But it's almost like it's definitely a romance. It's a love story and something that is so positive and so sweet. It's not like me at all, actually. I'm not sure about this new side of myself. I think I like it.
Embrace every part of yourself, Lisa. It's vitally important. I'll ask Hilary, because we'll get into the specifics of Cork's Shaky Bridge. You can tell me, Hilary, as a native of Cork, how romantic a spot is Cork's Shaky Bridge?
It's pretty romantic. Now, I've never had any romance on that bridge myself, but it is really iconic. It's a massive part of the city and it's really beautiful looking down the river. It's the bridge that joins the north side into the city. So it's a really, really wonderful spot. And there's lovely little private shady spots as well. So I can understand how Lisa would find the romance there, right?
Yeah, I was wondering if Cork Shaky Bridge was one of those spots. If somebody said to you, do you want to come down to the bridge? Would you be thinking, oh, no, there must be a question about to be popped or something like that? Does it have that kind of reputation, or is that just the old romantic in me, perhaps, Hilary?
You know what? But what does go on there, and it's reflected in the story, it's a swimming spot, and it's an inner city swimming spot, which is really cool. So yeah. I think that probably lends itself to a bit of a romance, you know.
Nicely batted off into play. Thank you. I'm sure there's a lot more goes on around the Shaky Bridge than swimming as well, but we'll leave that maybe for another day. Let's have a listen to the beginning of the story, actually, because obviously there's Lisa's writing is an important element of it, Hilary's performance, but there's another aspect in here as well, which we'll hear in this opening section.
Come here, that origin story boy. I have a few things to put straight in your head. I didn't fall in love with you 6 months later when we found ourselves working together in Reardon's, or even a month after that, when we had the ride that was, in hindsight, ill-advised, us both being langers. I certainly didn't fall in love with you after you made that speech as we sat on the bonnet of your I-30 at Rocky Bay. The speech you tell everyone melted my hard little heart. I lost my mind by the Shaky Bridge. It should have been the first thing I said to you, to your kind eyes and your laughing mouth and your confident hands. Sorry now, are you aware I'm after losing my mind? I should have warned you before I'd even cleared the water from my eyes. You're very good to ask if you can help, but I've a feeling you should jog on. Something's after snapping in me. You'd be ruined before you even said, are you alright? I don't know up from down anymore. I don't know river from dry land. My mind was slipping as it was. I was that sure I was a goner. My lungs were bursting, every muscle in both legs seizing up. I sprinted onto the bridge so fast, so hard, I thought I was going to be the one to finally shake it loose. The one who broke the shaky bridge.
I just love that opening to that story. I don't know why it's not called I Lost My Mind by the Shaky Bridge, which sounds like the title of a country and western song as well. But the story is actually called Town, A Love Story in Body Parts. Lisa McInerney wrote it, Hilary Rose performing it. We heard part of it there. And this is all part of this, a city and a garden project. I didn't talk about the third element in it. And I think you were very excited in particular about this, Hilary. You wanted to be part of a Lisa McInerney story, but the music element was vital to you as well.
That's right. Yeah. So, I mean, like, it's a couple of things came into play when I was asked to do it. Firstly, Mary Hickson, who's part of Sounds of a Safe Harbour, you know, like her name was bandied about. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to work with Mary. She's cool. And then it was Lisa. And I was like, oh, I love Lisa's writing. Like, I'm a massive fan. And then the third element that came into it was music, an original score by Greg and Shane, otherwise known as Fish Go Deep. And they're just, you know, like house music icons from many decades ago in Cork when I used to go to Sir Henry's. And Lisa, you were probably in Sir Henry's at that time as well, I would imagine.
I definitely was.
Does Sir Henry's, I've only heard the first 7 minutes of the story. Does Sir Henry's make its way into the story or do we move around the city, Lisa? What happens a bit further on?
So, like, without doing any spoilers, no, yeah. Sir Henry's is long gone, unfortunately, at this point. Mm. But the characters, they move from the shaky bridge and they make their way through town. It ends up at Red Abbey Tower. They make their way through town, kind of pursued by a couple of shady characters. And as our two characters walk past, they go up, they go by UCC, they go down Lancaster Quay, they kind of take us on a journey all that down that side of Cork. Mm. And as they do there, they slowly fall in love by losing bits of themselves. It's very, very nice. Honestly, it's not like me at all.
I think it's wonderfully romantic. But Hilary, you can put something to rest because Lisa was on with me. Was it a fortnight ago, I think, or thereabouts, Lisa? You were on talking about the current novel, the third part of your trilogy, as it were, The Rules of Revelation. Have I got that right? Yes, I do. Yes, The Rules of Revelation. And I complimented Lisa very happily on the Cork accent and patois, as I refer to it in the book. And I thought perhaps as a Monaghan man, that was a little bit high-handed of me. You can settle it. Was I right in complimenting her on her ability with the Cork accent? It's there in the opening section of the story, as we heard, Hilary.
Oh, absolutely. That's what I love about Lisa's writing, actually, that she really captures not just the city, but the characters so crisply and so perfectly. I think it's all there in the writing. It's really, really gorgeous, but it's also like she makes these characters kind of tough on the exterior, but really vulnerable, which is what's really beautiful about it. So, yeah, she captures Cork, I think, absolutely perfectly.
So there you go. You've got a real imprimatur now, Lisa. It's about 40 minutes or thereabouts, the story, isn't it? So the idea is that you can walk along and listen to the story as you go to the various locations in which the story is set or where the story brings you. But it's not a travel guide. It's not going to be turn left up onto whatever the name of the street is now. And to your right, you will see such and such a building. It's not that type of story. It's kind of a more imaginative journey than a tour guide journey, Lisa.
Yeah, I mean, the great thing about the project for me was being able to write a piece of fiction in and around rediscovering kind of outdoor spaces and kind of exploring our cities and stuff, which is like what we're doing with our outdoor summer now and trying to reconnect with it in a way. So, I mean, the idea that you would kind of go along and somebody would say, well, look to your left, this is St. Finbarr's Cathedral. It was built in, you know, there's enough of those out there. Hmm. The idea is you're seeing the city through the eyes of characters because this is it. We share our cities. They're living spaces and we share them with other people that experience it in different ways. So to be able to kind of take a walk and kind of feel, I guess, what the characters are feeling and kind of, you know, that wonderful kind of soundtrack from Greg and Shane mirroring the heartbeats that are happening. And there's some lovely art installation will be along the way too. So you're going to see kind of cool little things as well from the story. I think it should be like a whole body experience. That's what I reckon anyway.
And was I presume the route was very familiar to you, Hilary, or did you go and take a little walk around it as part of your research and method acting mode of getting into the story?
No, it's really familiar to me, actually. Like, we would have done, well, obviously, like, I'm from Cork City, but we would have filmed a lot for Young Offenders in Cork City, and part of it actually was on the Shaky Bridge. And then up through UCC, I would know very well. And then you're going down Barrack Street, which is a really, really old part of the city. Mm. And it's amazing. It's full of quirky cafes and lovely little bars that are thankfully reopening now. And then down to Red Abbey. So Red Abbey is a really ancient part of the city and it's right smack bang in the middle of it, but nobody really knows it's there. It's kind of surrounded by these old houses just off South Douglas Street. And I've known it like for a very long time because my friend actually used to live around the corner from it. So as Lisa kind of says at the end, well, it's towards the end of the story, it's a little kind of a gathering spot right in the city, but it's lovely and secluded. So it's really gorgeous down there. So hopefully some people will rediscover it, as Lisa said.
And listen to the story as they go, if they want, or listen to the story and then go on the walk. And obviously yours is Route 1, which is from the Sunday's Well Road through to the Red Abbey Square. There's a second story set in Cork from the Mardyck Bridge Skate Park through to Bellsfield. That's Louise Hegarty's story, which will be narrated by Conor Lovett and music sung by Sean O'Shea. It's two stories set in Dublin in the National Botanic Gardens, believe it or not. The Name for Things by Malata Uchu Okorie. Tony McKay will be narrating that and Shahzad Ismaili will provide the music. And again, the local, the National Botanic Gardens in a story called Constance from Gavin Corbett, Sean McAlean, Dorothy Murphy and Kate Ellis providing the music and Dorothy Murphy also doing the narration as part of that as well. I have to say, it's a great way, Lisa, of getting yourself around a city in an imaginative way. Was it very different to write with a location as your starting point as opposed to the sound of a character's voice or, you know, the character, his or herself?
Yeah, it was very different for me to kind of have to take as each jumping off point of the story a physical space, because for me it's always been I start with a voice and of a character and work from there, so I kind of had to go backwards with it. And I always say that one of my weaknesses is setting, so you know, actually having to go in and tackle it, it's made me a better person, I'll be honest with you. But it's a nice thing to be able to do. It's nice to be able to kind of tackle fiction, tackle storytelling in different ways and have different triggers for it. It was very exciting. You know, I'm so delighted with how it came together and just to have Hillary's voice on it and to have Greg and Shane. I mean, like, I'm thrilled with it. Like, I think it's wonderful.
Well, certainly, as I said, I've heard the first 7 minutes and I can't wait to hear the rest of it to see what happens and what happens when love blossoms. If love blossoms, I'll have to wait and find out. I'm going to finish up by listening to a second clip, but I'll say thanks to both of you now, Lisa McInerney, writer, and Hillary Rose, actor there, whose recording of Town, A Love Story and Body for Parts will be available from this Friday. I'll give you more details. But thanks for being with us this evening, Hilary and Lisa. And let's go to a little bit further into the story and we'll find out where they are now and what are they up to.
There was heat in the sun. I was shielded between a tree on the bank and your jacket. And I took my clothes off and put your clothes on and was glad I'd shaved my legs. Where you living? You asked. And I told you. Oh, we're neighbours, so you laughed. I'll walk you home, you said. And off we went. Me in your hoodie and your black cotton jocks passed. Are you for real? And the light on the water sparkled, danced, buzzed with flying insects, rippled from the fellas jumping from the bridge behind us. I wasn't so presumptuous to think I might have to warn you off, which seems just delicious now.
Oh yeah, I knew there was more going on that shaky bridge than they were telling me. Town, A Love Story in Body Parts is that story from Lisa McInerney, narrated by Hilary Rose. 4 routes in total, 2 in Dublin, 2 in Cork City, and people in those cities are invited to log on to the website cityandgarden.ie, walk along the route and experience what they see from the point of view of a genuine native. Of course, even if you're not in the cities, can't you log on and imagine yourself into the very various locations if that's what you show so with. 3 years ago, choreographer Siobhan Nichonin began to help her father, Padraig, build a 3-hand West Kerry Na Bhog type of boat off Newstorrow at sea in the west of Ireland. Padraig O'Donnell is a traditional boat builder, and now in a slight turning of the tables, he has collaborated with his daughter to build a new dance work called Bod Hiwan, and that is inspired in some ways by their earlier joint enterprise. It'll be streamed as part of Cork Midsummer Festival from the 18th through until the 20th of June. And Siobhan Nicodine, Paddy Godinine, join me now from Cork. To what extent, Siobhan? I know you grew up surrounded by boats, but to what extent did the experience of building that boat with your father, Padraig, a few years, whatever it is, 3 years ago now, did that feed directly into time to turn the tables and get him to do a bit of work for me?
I totally intended for Dad to be part of a dance when we started building a boat together. So I knew from the very beginning that this was an opportunity for me to learn his craft, and I hoped for him to learn something about mine. We worked together in a cold November, putting the boat together, beginning to stretch the wood and steam it. I started to learn. I did junior cert woodwork. I thought I had all the skills, but I didn't, as I soon found out. And he had to teach me the real basics, how to hammer a nail properly and saw a piece of wood. And all of that really has informed the dance that happened after. Yeah, a lot of the materials that we used in the boat, you'll see in the piece, and you'll hear sounds of the workshop, and I suppose fundamentally the rhythm of working together comes through very strongly.
Yeah, I saw a little bit of a work in progress video that you sent along. I had a look at it today, and there's a lovely section where the both of you are balancing these very long pieces of wood on your heads. I think they're 5.5 metres long, and they're beginning to curve like the way they would if they were being shaped to go into a boat. But Padraig, let me come to you and ask you if you could describe for us, for those of us who haven't seen a three-hand West Kerry Navogue, which I've no doubt you'll tell me is the best boat that ever sailed the Atlantic Ocean, but will you describe what it looks like and what makes it specific to West Kerry?
Well, it is the best, most seaworthy boat of its size that exists in the world. So we can get that out of the way. But it's basically like a big basket, very finely shaped, that meets the surf and meets the sea and sits on the water in a really safe way that puts you totally in touch with the ocean when you're out there. And they say, it's not true actually, but there's no straight piece in it. So everything is curved and bent. And the part that I appreciate most is the shaping of the hull. So you're shaping what meets the ocean. And that is really smoothing it out. It's sculpture, really. So, and then it's hard work and a reasonable level of hand skills. And
you've described it perfectly. Is it generally used as a fishing vessel then, or would it have been used to get people to and from islands and that type of thing as well, Padraig?
Well, it's very much in the past now, but it was essential, say, for the Blasket Islanders. They abandoned the island basically because they hadn't enough able-bodied men to, in an emergency, to face the ocean and get a sick person ashore. So they were essential to the lives of the people. But they also were their sport, they were their holidays, they were their journeys south and north. So they were they carried the animals, they carried the gas bottles.
Hugely important, obviously, in the practicalities of any kind of island or coastal life, then, is what you're describing to me. The other thing that strikes me about it, Siobhan, it's a three-hand West Kerry Navogue. So I'm presuming that, does that mean that you have three people on board, Siobhan, who are actually doing the rowing?
Usually, yes. And the reason it's a three-hand West Kerry Navogue is because that's the first boat that Dad got the year I was born. So there's a kind of a continuity. We looked at that boat as a draft to make the new one. And that three-hand West Kerry na Bhog thread has come all the way through then into the dance work.
Yeah, and a lovely detail that it was the first boat, as you said, the Padraig got the very year that you were born as well. But that idea of three people on board a vessel like that rowing on the sea, I'm guessing there must be great synchronicity between the three rowers and almost a type of choreography in the way they would move and behave on the boat itself.
Absolutely, and that's something that really connects, I think, dancing and rowing, and I've done a bit of both, of course. I think with a lot of physical labour, they say it about writing as well, though I wouldn't know as much about that, but there's a kind of a flow. I think many people have experienced it when you get into a certain rhythm and things are just so easeful. You're still attending to what's there, you're aware of what's around you, you're in tune with the other people in the boat or the people you're dancing with, and then things fly, and that's a really exciting place to be, and that's something that Dad and I certainly connected over in both processes.
Yeah, I would have thought, Padraig, what Siobhan is describing there, that idea of flow, not just in the process of or in the act of rowing a boat, I guess in the act of making it and building it as well. The way you were describing smoothing out the pieces of woods and getting the curves into them that you would need, obviously, to give us the shape of a boat. I guess that has to have a type of flow and choreographed almost movement to it as well.
Yes, and it's something that develops when you're working with somebody for a while, and it is the same ease, and there's less vocalization. So the level of words drops, and we're all on the same boat as to what's happening. Mm. And it becomes, we can predict each other's moves, and it is heaven.
Well, did that happen then between yourself and Siobhan, first of all, 3 years ago when you were in charge, I'm guessing, in the building of the boat? Did that kind of synchronicity, that kind of ability to just work around each other without words, did that fall into place, Padraig?
Well, it was there. We found it. It would come and go. That's the kind of nature of it. But it's just working with somebody physically, particularly at a trade, I feel, but that's my own experience. You can get that space where through the apprentice having observed, call it the apprentice, then they know what's next, maybe. And that's a really deep form of learning, actually.
But what was it like then, the other way around for you, Padraig, when it was you were the apprentice when it came into, I presume, when it came into the onto the dance floor? This idea that Siobhan would choreograph the piece in and around the building of the boat, obviously. But what was your initial thoughts when she said, "I want to do a dance piece, Dad"? Agus beidh tosa ann.
Well, I knew that was on the cards, but ferocious apprehension would be the simple way of putting it, because it's so physical as well. So I remember very clearly the first outing on a floor. This is totally there was somebody with us, but jostling, pushing each other across the floor, leaning against each other, and That's really okay. This is okay, because there's a lot. There's father, daughter, and then you have to become dancer. Mm. And so there's a lot of switches and things you have to do. So because of how professional Siobhan is, and she's been at it for so long, I just felt, okay, this is fine. I'll do what I'm told, maybe. Do what I'm told, even.
Yeah. There you go. So you did what you were told. Did you approach Siobhan then? It was your idea, obviously, to go ahead with this and to kind of put it to your father. Or maybe it was a quid pro quo. You said, if I build a boat, you'll do the dance. Did you have ferocious apprehension, to use your father's phrase? Or were you slightly less apprehensive than he was?
I was much less apprehensive, though I was aware of his tendency not to do what he's told. So that took a while. That took a while to shift and find a nice balance of working. I was really thrilled when Dad said he'd do it. I had the idea had started a while back, and in one of those kind of moments that's really exciting as an artist, a few things came together, and I was working with an Irish language theatre collective called Gari and Yeria. Mm. We had the chance to be kind of mentored by Phelim Cannon from Broken Talkers, and Phelim had done a piece with his mother, Have I No Mouth? And working with this, I just started a new role as dance artist in residence in Gaeltacht Fuascrí, where my grandparents are from. So I was in this kind of melting pot of realising, okay, I'm actually in a quite a privileged position to know people who really live tradition in different ways and who speak the Irish language on a daily basis, and who've made amazing work with intimate work with family members, and all of those things came together, and I thought, wow, there's so much that Dad knows, and even though I've been around a lot of it for most of my childhood, there are things I also don't know and I'd love to know, and the practicalities of the boat was something I was really curious about. And then also, I mean, people ask me, oh, how is Dad dancing? But actually, I also always remember Dad dancing. So it's a part of, in a sense, the way that the boat was part of my just daily family life. Dancing was my profession and is my profession, and there was a kind of a switch with Dad where the boats are his profession and dancing was part of every occasion, or just a you know, rave around the kitchen to a good tune on the radio. So,
August and Will, Will Gaeilge, do we have actually spoken language within the piece, Siobhan?
Yeah, tá scéalta agus scoiling agus bearla ann, and it felt too rich to exclude language as well. I mean, one of the great things about working alongside someone is the stories that come, and stories I hadn't heard about family or about the boats, traditions, things that Dad had heard from people who he had built boats with. So I decided, I mean, I'm very much about what's in the room and what are the materials to hand, and if they're rich and readily available and coming through in the work anyway, I mean, they kind of have to be used.
Well, to finish up then with you, Padraig, was there a particular story that you were very keen to have as part of the performance, or one that you really wanted to tell to be sure that you could get it out there?
Well, there is a story in English in it which is quite significant for me personally, and it will be out there. So,
and how much of it will you tell me, or how will you give me a hint what area it's in?
Well, it's around a heart condition is one way of looking at it, which has been part of this dance. I have atrial fibrillation, so my level of activity has to be watched. So that has been a kind of an up and down thing. And there is a story around that which is a story. It's a story.
Well, great. Well, I look forward to hearing it and seeing. Míle buíochas san bhfeirteach ubh as bheith a linn an ocht.
Fáilte rós.
Míle maith
agat. Agus sin Páirc á Odanín agus Aníon. Siobhan ní Odanín, Páirc and Siobhan Dineen there. Báil Chuan is the title of the show. It'll be streamed as part of Cork Midsummer Festival from the 18th through to the 20th of June. And you can find out full details on corkmidsummer.com. In an industrial site at the edge of Carlow town, the rhythm of machines and people stopped a long time ago. The former Braun factory is a well-known landmark which has stood idle for a number of years. But Visual and Carlow Arts Festival will be bringing back light and sound to that venue this weekend. Woman in the Machine will unfold through film, exhibitions, soundworks, light installations, a 360-degree virtual exhibition space and performances inspired by the film Sisters with Transistors by Lisa Rovner, and women working at the intersection of art, science and digital media. I'm joined this evening by Jo Mangan, Director and CEO of Carlo Arts Festival, to tell us a little bit more about it. And the Braun Factory, I'm saying Braun, I don't know which people say in Carlo, I'm presuming they say Braun like I say, Jo. It's quite an imposing building for sure, but it used to be so vital to the business life and the and employment in the town.
Absolutely. It's a huge landmark. It's a visual landmark, but as you say, it's where, like, there's hardly anyone I have spoken to in Carlow that doesn't have some connection to it, whether they've worked in it themselves or whether relations of theirs worked there. It was a huge employer at the time. And as you say, it's like it has lived large and loomed large in people's imagination since then, and kind of in some ways come to represent a kind of loss of a sort of industrial heritage that was very pertinent in Carlow. And I'm hoping that this project that we've done with Visual will really kind of turn the corner on it and start to give people new hope and new ideals around properties like this. As it happens, it's for sale. So it's kind of really good timing. And we've hopped in on that wonderful time in a building's life, especially a huge, imposing and attractive building like this for people working in the arts. Like, we've hopped in at that sweet spot before it moves on to its next life. So we're really thrilled to be in there. It's actually, it's a real privilege.
Yeah, and I guess it in some ways, from what you're saying, it was a kind of a no-brainer that you would take this former manufacturing plant in many ways and turn it into what will be, for the period of this event and these events, it will be a very creative space.
Yeah, it has been already. We've been a few weeks in it, installed a huge amount of visual art in the main and sound art, all of which was filmed, has been is in the editing studio as we speak, and then was deinstalled and reinstalled at Visual, obviously because of COVID. So we really want people to see the work that was installed there. That's, you know, the incredible technicians in Visual led by Emma Lucy O'Brien spent 2 weeks installing, but we couldn't let anyone in to see it. So, you know, the wonderful thing, I suppose, is notwithstanding that fact, is that people can go see the artworks in situ and Visual. And what we're doing at the weekend coming up on Friday is that film that we made, which is kind of impressionistic version of what the installation was, and all the various performers, from circus performers to roller skaters through to a DJ, the amazing Kate Butler. So that film will be shown, and some of the performers that were part of the making of that film will be on site. So we're trying to, it's been an incredible process, you know. I mean,
yeah, and given where we're at with COVID right now, Jo, it will be a mix of, you can have a number of people, I think, in the venue. Am I right in thinking that? But albeit a limited number. So there will be people live there, if you like, as well as watching it online and watching it being streamed.
Yeah, I mean, we're not actually going to stream it this weekend. We're really focusing on that kind of live iteration, where we do have some of the 70 odd artists that we've worked with on the piece able to present their work to an audience, albeit an audience outside and the performers inside. It's a massive, weird, wonderful hybrid that we've had to kind of pivot on, you know, so many occasions in terms of the imagining of it. And I suppose that's why we're really keen to that people get that it is a much bigger project than actually just what's going on site this weekend. Whilst we're wild excited about that, of course, and we're working with Sarah Jane Shields, who's created this incredible design to light up that massive stack that anyone who has passed through Carlo will have seen, with the Braun logo on it. And that's going to happen across the weekend, obviously in the twilight and the late night hours, because it wouldn't read in the daylight. But it's we've also got an installation which has been created by architect Emma Gagan and students from Technical University Dublin, architecture students, that really kind of mine the history of that site and the social history. And that's available for people to view, you know, without coming into the site. So we're kind of trying to reach out to people who can't necessarily come to the live event, to make sure that certainly all of the town and the surroundings is aware that it's all going down in Braun.
And tell me then where the film Sisters with Transistors, the Lisa Rovner film that really looked at the untold story of electronic music's female pioneers, how did that influence this project, and how do you think that's manifesting itself in the event that will be happening this weekend?
I suppose the obvious thing is that we call the event Woman in the Machine. So, you know, you look at incredible industrial sites like this and you start to think about, you know, who built it, who worked in it. Your mind immediately, maybe it's the inherent bias, but your mind immediately goes to the men. But actually, very quickly, we discovered that a lot of women worked on the factory line in Braun. They were creators of kind of, you know, some of the smaller electronic items that you might be familiar with, like toothbrushes and shavers. And we really wanted to highlight that. And we really wanted to highlight the female experience in incredible buildings like this. And we discovered actually kind of far enough into the project, just a few weeks ago, got a call from a woman who told me that the lead architect on the building was a woman.
This is Angela Dupe, is it?
Correct. Yeah. Which was a real revelation to us. So there was something about that building and about that site that drew us to programming women, to programming, you know, women working in arts and tech. And there's some really fascinating people and always have been, you know, the first coders having been women. So it was a real kind of beautiful and sad surprise because unfortunately Angela died very recently, to discover that she was the lead architect on the piece under the IDA.
Yeah, but how great it is that you can now actually acknowledge that. I know it's one of those classics. It's not that it was hidden, but it was just never told, I suppose. It's one of those type of stories, isn't it?
Exactly. And, you know, we're having a lot of talks at the moment in the virtual festival campus, which is this 360 environment that you referenced at the top. And all of those conversations are involving women. And a lot of those conversations are involving women working in music, in electronics, in technology. I just am off a call with Jen Kirby, who we've commissioned, and Jennifer Moore. And, you know, it's fascinating listening to these incredible women who are DIY, electronic DIYers, artistic DIYers, who are able to make incredible things without leaning on anyone else for their creativity. And like, this is a platform, I suppose, a virtual platform, an online platform, and a real platform for some of those artists to share their work. And the connections between those women, you know, I'm already feeling work will happen. It almost feels like we kind of created an artist residency in some respects. So those people are going to cross-pollinate and develop work into the future, I have no doubt.
As I was saying about the Lisa Rovner film, Sisters with Transistors, very much an untold story, and she does such a great job in telling that story to us in the film about very important women who were involved in the early stages of electronic music. You mentioned people like the DJ Kate Butler. What about their experience? I mean, has she spoken to you, or is this part of what has been discussed in recent weeks? The whole idea of the current situation regarding women working and producing electronic music.
For sure. I mean, Kate is a real advocate for particularly young women in electronic music. And as a DJ herself and someone who works in Dublin Digital Radio, she has spoken at length about the fact that she will go out of her way to platform female and Irish artists. And, you know, I think it's that sort of positive affirmation in any aspect of the arts and in life, I suppose, that things are not going to move on. We're not going to brush back the leaves of history and see the extraordinary women who are making work and in a contemporary way the same. We're not going to see those people unless they're pushed forward, because I suppose a lot of women in particular working in that environment work alone. They work in a very solitary way, and sticking your head above the parapet and putting your work out there is always difficult for artists, and you never know how it's going to be received. So like, I'm really delighted that this is a generous project. It's an inclusive project. It's something that I think will have resonances, you know, for a long, long time to come. So I'm really thrilled. It was something that came about. It was, you know, in the ether for a long time, but the Brightening Air project really helped, you know, pull that together so that ourselves at the festival and Visual were able to actually go ahead and do this. It wouldn't have happened without that sudden injection that happened a few months ago.
Some of the publicity material refers to this 72-hour lost weekend that's in store. Is it? Are we actually getting 72 hours of events?
I wish. But what Kate has done actually is she has made a 72-minute mix. Mm. So it's not 72 hours, but it's a 72-minute mix, which will be available on the website from tomorrow. So that whole womaninthemachine.com website opens up tomorrow. So access to all these people's work will be, you know, the films, etc., will all be, you know, they'll all be available to the public from tomorrow on that website, which is brilliant. So we're thrilled about that. The 72-hour lost weekend refers to what we would have done if we could have done. So we would have opened that site up and had the best party you'd ever want to go to for 72 hours where you wander home maybe for a few hours and come back in the middle of the afternoon. It's still going. So it's the most condensed version of that you can imagine. Mostly virtual.
Can you tell? You mentioned the you know, that iconic sign, the bronze sign that is up on the side of the building, and you mentioned about, you know, a lighting installation in and around that. Is there a specific moment when the people of Carlow might be able to look out and see that? Because I'd say it'd be hugely emotional when that actually lights up.
Yeah, I mean, we did a tester a couple of weeks ago because we wanted to film it for the film as well, and sent up a drone. So there were ripples already in the like 10 minutes it was live of people having seen it kind of accidentally. But yeah, 10 o'clock Friday, it's going live and it'll run until 4 a.m. because that's when the light starts to creep back in. Each night of the weekend, so Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
All right. So would that be an amazing thing to see? Thanks for speaking to us about everything regarding that.
Pleasure,
this evening.
Sure.
That's Joe Mangan there, and Woman in the Machine takes place from the 11th through to the 13th of June at that former Brown factory in Carlow. Further details can be found on the website womaninthemachine.com or on carlowartsfestival.com. Twelve minutes to eight on Wednesday night's Arena. The RTÉ National Symphony Orchestra live series continues this Friday evening with conductor Robert Houlihan turning the spotlight on three of Ireland's finest composers, Marian Inglesby, Jane O'Leary and Gráinne Mulvey. Delighted to be joined by two of those composers this evening, both of whose work evokes foreign places and travel. Jane O'Leary's From the Flatirons refers to the magnificent mountain range of Colorado, while Gráinne Mulvey's world premiere of Latitude 52 brings us from the southeast of Ireland to Newfoundland. And Gráinne and Jane, as I say, joining us on the programme this evening. Gráinne, Latitude 52, I was kind of surprised when I read that, in fact, this is the world premiere taking place on the 11th of June 2021, but with the RTÉ National Symphony Orchestra, obviously. But the piece is 18 years old. That's a long time from the realisation of a piece to the performance of a piece, I guess.
Yes, it is, Sean. It's an extremely long time. It was actually part of a competition between Waterford Institute of Technology and St. John's Memorial University of Newfoundland. Because in 2003, both institutions were twinned at that time. And the brief for the competition was to write a chamber orchestral piece that I won. But unfortunately, it never got a performance. Mm. It just didn't materialise. There were attempts and then things just fell apart. And now, thankfully, because of COVID, it's actually going to see its premiere. So that's a great thing. And I'm very grateful to the RTÉ National Symphony Orchestra and Robert Houlihan for making it happen.
Has that got to do as much as anything else, Gráinne, with it, you know, the type of the size of orchestra that we can now put on the stage in COVID times when there are restrictions? The size is perfect for the instrumentation and the forces that you employ in Latitude 52.
Yes, Sean, that's exactly correct, because everybody is very much, you know, masked. And of course, you have screens for the wind instruments and that to kind of cover themselves and protect themselves. So it's just fitting that it is the case that it can happen now at this stage. It probably might never have seen the light of day, and I would have just put that back to, you know, the recesses of my brain further away in the distance and thought it'll never RC Light. So it's just a very good opportunity. So that's fortunate.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, a first performance, no matter how old the piece is, it must be a very exciting moment for any composer. But turning to you, Jane O'Leary, you have heard Flatirons before, but getting pieces performed and re-performed and re-performed is a vital part of any contemporary composer's desires, I would have thought.
Hi, Sean, indeed. Yes, I know there's a lot of emphasis on premieres and first performances, but yes, I agree. I think it's more important to get second and third and fourth, you know, and to have a piece grow with repeated performances. But this is actually a little unusual, the history of this piece. It had a studio recording back in 1989 with no audience, again, with the NSO. And then it had a public performance at the International Congress on Women in Music in Bilbao in 92. And there was an audience, but it was funny, it was with reduced forces, so only solo strings rather than a full orchestral string section. So on Friday, we've got the full orchestra with the three wind instruments, but no audience.
And that title,
still ways to go.
Yeah, well, the no audience thing is just interesting that it should be there the second time round for very different reasons, I'm guessing, than the first time round, obviously. Flatirons, where does that title come from, Jane, and what does it tell us about what was in your mind in the piece?
Yeah, it's very evocative. Well, the piece is not a new piece, Sean. It's nearly 37 years old. It was written back in 1984-85. And in January 84, I went to Boulder, Colorado, to join my husband, Pat, who was on a sabbatical at the University of Colorado in Boulder. It's just outside of Denver. And the landscape of Boulder is dominated by this incredible mountain range, the foothills of the Rocky Mountains. And it's just overwhelming. It's these huge mountain peaks that are sort of triangular, pointed at the top, and they're flat, like as if they were sheared off. And they call them the Flatirons. And they're very famous because they look like irons standing up, you know. The whole town is dominated by this image. And it's kind of an atmosphere of majesty and mystery. And so I often call my pieces by a title which tells where I am when I'm writing it. And in this case, From the Flatirons. I've done another one called From Sea Grey Shores that refers to Connemara and Renville House. So this sense of majesty that the mountains give. Conveyed comes into the music, I think.
Yeah, and if we listen to a little bit from the opening section from the first movement of the work, I think we get what you just described to us visually. We get, an aural representation of this in the music. And this is from Jane O'Leary's The Flatirons, the first movement, and it's the RTE National Symphony Orchestra recording that featured Colman Peel. Little section there from the opening of Jane O'Leary's Flatirons, a piece that will be performed as part of this Friday evening's RTE National Symphony Orchestra live series. Jane is with me on the programme this evening, as is composer Grainne Mulvey, whose piece Latitude 52 will be performed on Friday evening as well. As you said, Jane, we have that sense of a very imposing majesty and a kind of a darkness as well in the strings section of that, which is, as you described, the mountains themselves. Then the woodwind seem to bring in a different element. It's in a concerto in that respect. We have, what are the three wind instruments that we have, if you like, in conversation with the strings?
Absolutely. It's actually called a concerto for flute, oboe, and clarinet and strings. So you've just the three wind instruments. But the whole idea of a concerto is an interesting concept. And I didn't think of it in the kind of romantic terms of soloist versus huge orchestra, or in the Baroque term of kind of alternating groups. But It's more just different colors. It's like a tapestry of different colors, and the winds have this bright, clear sound and punctuate the texture, whereas the strings are more solid and fluid. But they also have pizzicato, which goes with the short notes in the wind. So it's really a question of colors and contrasting and blending different kinds of colors.
Doing in sound what the mountains themselves do in visual, I guess. Grainne, then, in The Kiss of Latitude 52, that's a reference to a specific line of latitude, I'm guessing, in and around Newfoundland or Newfoundland.
Yes, and it is, and it's, we passed through that line of latitude, and our coast, we're off the coast mainly of Wicklow and Wexford area, so it passes right through the world as well, other areas, but it is significant because we have that in common, and of course we have fisheries and emigration and everything else, and the Brendan Voyage, and you know, a lot of different explorers who went to Newfoundland, and so it's in around that latitude, so that was the common thing, because we needed to find a common title for the piece, and that was it then.
That was how you did. And obviously you haven't heard the piece yet, you've heard it in your mind, I'm sure, when you were composing it. Have you heard any of the rehearsals yet, or will Friday night be your big moment of revelation?
I have heard some of the rehearsals. Yeah, I was there today. So they're fine, and they're working away on parts of it and everything. So it kind of depicts the kind of perilousness of the seas. And there's lots of kind of like different kind of spectral harmony operating within it as well. Yeah. So it's just... It has, textures and things that operate and that are very maybe tumultuous and then very flat as well. And, good dialogue between the winds and the strings.
And obviously we can't hear any of it because Friday night is the world premiere. But you did suggest maybe that we might listen to another of your pieces just to get a sense of your own composition. I love this. Is it Akenos? Is that how I say that word? And swirly texture.
Akenos.
Tell me a little bit about swirly texture and where it fits into Akenos.
Yeah, well, Akenos derives its name from the acanthus plant, and it's a tropical plant that lives in Asia, and it lives in the Mediterranean as well. So the Greek name is Akenos. So it's a very good plant that survives in arid conditions. It's quite spiky, and the idea of foliage and textures and things convey the type of foliage, the branches, and the greenness of the actual plant itself. So I use quite a lot of spectral harmony because that's nice. That conjures up those nice kind of depth of texture.
We'll finish up by listening to a little bit of Akenos and swirly textures, and thanks to both you, Grainne Mulvey, and Jane O'Leary for being with us this evening. And here's a little sample of Grainne Mulvey's Akenos Swirly Textures. Music of Grainne Mulvey there, and you'll be hearing that world premiere of Latitude 52 on this coming Friday evening, along with From the Flatirons from Jane O'Leary, the RTÉ National Symphony Orchestra conducted by Robert Houlihan, and the third piece on the evening will be Marion Inglesby's Winter Sun. And you can find out full details this Friday, the 11th of June, 7 p.m, and it will be streamed live on RTÉ Culture, rteculture.ie. That's our lot for this evening. Liam Murphy, Paula Shields researched, Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator, Mark McGraw was on sound this evening. Tonight's programme produced by Ola McGann. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.